Charles.
It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Afternoon Classics après-midi here on KRVS. Coming up at 4, All Things Considered from NPR News. We begin the hour by heading straight into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
And joining me by telephone is Nathan Rabelais. He is Assistant Professor of Francophone Studies here at UL Lafayette. He has just published a book through LSU Press, Folklore Figures of French and Creole Louisiana. It's a pretty fascinating book, Nathan, and I know you've worked very long and hard on this book. Some people, and we want to stress that this is about folklore figures. A lot of books have the word folklore in their titles, and this is not just about Cajun customs or Creole customs, but specifically about the folklore figures. So I want to ask you to start by explaining what you mean by folklore figures, just for people who may not be familiar with them.
Sure. Yeah, and thanks again for having me on the show. It's always fun to talk with you. I'm going to maybe sum it up in a simple way if I can. So the folklore figures, what I mean by that is stories. Mm-hmm. So stories that are passed on from generation to generation from within French and Creole speaking Louisiana. So they go back, you know, quite a few years. The oldest tales that I have in there are from the late 19th century. The late 1800s, and I use the word figures because sometimes characters, the word characters can imply that they have a specific name, where you might have the similar type of, that's why I use the word figure, the fool, the trickster, there's even a chapter on anti-clerical humor, where there's sort of like a trickster priest is also another kind of folklore figure that's found quite a bit. And so I think figure is just a little bit more broad, so that even when the same kind of tales prop up and the same kind of characters appear with just different names, we can still study it as the same phenomenon, the same kind of figure. And also sometimes they're not all human or or animate things, so they could be like the fofolé,
right,
a folklore figure that,
yeah, it's not even not, animal.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. The figure is, I thought, was just kind of a good term to embody all those different things.
It is. It's a very nice word. And you know, it's published by LSU Press, and it, you know, some people may think, oh, an academic book, but it is dealing with characters, figures, as you call them, that we're all somewhat familiar with, either through our grandparents or school. Or so there are a lot of things that, you know, people will hear you talk about that we are all familiar with. But this isn't just a listing of these figures or a listing of the stories that you've discovered along the way. You have a very particular interest and way of shaping the history of these figures and these stories. And can you explain that? How did you start thinking about how to present these figures in this book?
It was difficult, to be honest. But it's something that there's a lot of trial and error, I think. But it is, like you mentioned, it is kind of an academic study. It's with the university press, but it really is written with a wider audience in mind, like a lot of LSU Press's things are. That's one of the main things that set them apart, I think, as a press, is how they're able to reach a wider readership, and that was really where to publish this. So I think it turned out well in that respect. As far as the organization, there are...
Well, I guess I meant not just so much organization as you do talk about right in the beginning, in the introduction, about this being kind of a historical psychoanalytic presentation. Mm-hmm. And that's really fascinating when you start talking about the history of the stories and the history of the different cultures. So I guess, right, that's, how did you get interested in doing it in that way, focusing on that, you know, psychoanalytic aspect of these stories?
It's something that I've been interested in for many years, probably when I was at Tulane working on my PhD. I was originally interested in medieval narrative and story structure and how those things are kind of universal. You know, there were, for example, things in like troubadour songs that I found in Cajun songs. And so that's what kind of got me started on this whole, journey, if you will, just looking at this kind of thing. And then I've always been interested in folk tales ever since I was little, and academically too. I just find them fascinating. And taking some courses with Barry Osley while I was doing my master's at UL about 10 years ago already, I had already learned about like Wookiee and Lapan and all the different West African and Caribbean influences. And of course, I knew about the French and Canadian influences in Louisiana folklore. And I wanted to go deeper into understanding where these different elements of Louisiana folklore came from. And as I did that, I did more and more archival research in France and looking at old anthologies from Haiti, from West Africa, from the Senegambia region, and more archival work in Moncton and in Nova Scotia. And I just I started to identify pretty early on a main body of tales that were in common, where the transfer of those characters and those tales were really clear, really just same character names, same tale types, same, so many details in common. And then, where you can really show the huge influx of immigration from those areas, it really confirms that that's where those certain parts of those tales came from. And then I got to really answer your question, what I got interested in at that point was, well, how are they different? Because they're obviously not exactly the same. So how did they change? And then why would they have changed in that way? And that's how I used sort of a lens of cultural trauma, because so many of the main groups of the big waves of immigration that you might think of in the 17th and 18th century in Louisiana, they weren't for what you might call positive reasons. So people were fleeing some kind of persecution or deportation, obviously slavery, the slave trade, and so there were a lot of traumatic experiences that were shared by different groups in French and Creole speaking Louisiana over the years. And I think the argument that I make in the book is that those shared traumas really changed the moral landscape in the folk tales, so that people had to, they're using the folk tales to teach a lesson to especially younger people. Well, what are the challenges that they're going to face? What are the lessons that you're going to need to teach them through these stories? And obviously, your experience will change what kind of lessons you think are important. If you're oppressed or discriminated against, or you need to be clever or cunning to survive, then those things come through.
Well, I want to say it probably also determined the particular tales and figures that survived in Louisiana as opposed to the rest of the American South, because there is a lot, folklore figures in the American South that aren't necessarily found in Louisiana. Ours is quite unique. And so I'd imagine it is those shared cultural traumas and very particular cultures and traumas that determined what figures and tales we continued to tell here in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think there's a few examples that I point out throughout the book where there was probably a reinforcement of at least two different traditions that contributed to certain figures' continued preservation. So, for example, the Bookie and Lapin that a lot of people know. Bookie is sort of the dupe, and Lapin, the rabbit trickster, is the one that's always playing tricks on Bookie. Well, you find the same kind of trickster dupe dynamic in the French tradition with the wolf and the fox. You know, the wolf is the slow one, and the fox is the trickster. There's a very interesting version of the fifolet, which sounds like fofolet, which is usually the will of the wisp, or the light on the water that could be made from, which is real. It's a real phenomenon that I think a lot of people are probably familiar with, sort of like swamp gas that's emitted from the water that looks like a candle. But in Pointe-Coupée Parish, there's another version of the fifolet told in Creole, in Louisiana Creole, that I think is from the 1930s. And it sounds more like almost like a vampire, but has the same name, you know. So there's a lot of confluence of different traditions that can they either take on another name from another language, or they just, I think, probably reinforce themselves because they're so similar.
Well, let's talk about some more of these stories. I know you have a really nice chapter on, you call it Bayou Bells. It's about fairy tales, and I guess we don't think of the stories that have come down as fairy tales. What is in that chapter, and how are our stories, our figures, connected to some of what we think of as some of the more classic fairy tales, European fairy tales?
That's an interesting question. It's odd because I think in a way, when people think about these kinds of stories, like the folk tales, a lot of people probably think about Cinderella and Beauty and the Beast and those more iconic fairy tales. And then in Louisiana, going back like to when people first started doing a lot of folklore research, like field work, especially in the 1930s and 40s, that's kind of what they were looking for. And they never found a whole lot, but that was, again, it was sort of like the quintessential tales that they wanted to find.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, there aren't that many, like in the whole, if you think about all the repertoire of folk tales and French and Creole that we have, either printed or archival, there's really not a lot that resemble like Cinderella or Snow White. But there are a few, and I thought that was important to include in the book because they're very different than what people might recognize, like in the Disney adaptations, for instance. Because a lot of what people know of, especially from Disney and the storybooks, they really come from Charles Perrault, which is from 17th century France. And those are really they're kind of like literary works.
And later than when the Acadians, I guess, you know, were, many of them were moving to Nova Scotia.
Right.
Or Acadie.
Right. So there are these really, really well-known versions that were kind of taken from the oral tradition, from storytellers, and then adapted for, in this case, like members of the court, and then for publication, for sale, like these really neatly packaged texts, you know, that really became literary works by a single person, like Perrault, or like the Grimm brothers. Just as a side note, I'm very careful in this book not to analyze any of those kind of things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's really only stuff from storytellers that have been collected by folklorists. And so that's another reason why it's interesting to look at these examples that were mostly taken from Avoyelles Parish in the 1940s by Calvin Claudel and Corinne Saussier, two folklorists, both from Avoyelles Parish. And there are a couple that I might talk about that I think are really interesting. One is called Snow Bella, which is like Snow White, and even has the little mirror kind of repetition,
mm-hmm.
and a refrain. And then there's also Cinderella, Cendrillon, both from Avoyelles Parish in the 1940s. And I think they're interesting because they show the heroine Cinderella or Snow Bella in a really different way, in that they're more I guess active, but like there's hardly any mention of the prince at all in Snow Bella. In the version that a lot of people know, she gets woken up from the sleep by a kiss from the prince. But in this version, in Louisiana. She's actually already taken. She's being moved by the Seven Dwarves, and like starts to regurgitate as they move her, and that's what she throws up the apple, and that's what wakes her up. It eventually goes after. It's not a queen, you know, which if you think about it, wouldn't make a lot of sense for people in that context to be talking about kings and queens in 1940s of Wells Parish. But she's like a, I think she might be a step, or just I think it's just this old woman. Sometimes it's a stepmother, and goes after her. I think with a shotgun while she's sitting on her porch, you know. So it's just really interesting how all these stories that I grew up with from Disney, you know, I think for a lot of people, that's my first reference of, about Snow White is the Disney cartoon. But it's just funny how all these little details are localized, so what's a word I use, sort of
Right.
adapted to the context, make it real. And Cinderella too is also I think has a lot more agency in this version from Louisiana. And at the end of the story, she before going to the castle to live with the prince, at the end she insists on using her own magic wand and bringing back her magic carriage, and she wants to take her own carriage to the castle. She doesn't want to ride with the prince. Just little details like that, I think, really set them apart in a
Yeah.
way.
Well, I want to tell people who are finding themselves interested by what you're describing. My guest is Nathan J. Rabelais. He is an assistant professor of Francophone Studies here at UL Lafayette. He's talking about his latest book entitled Folklore Figures of French and Creole Louisiana, which was recently published by LSU Press. So there's a lot of difference in South Louisiana between the stories you might find in Avoyelles Parish and something you might find further south of Lafayette, that those change quite a bit. Is that what you found in some of your research?
I think so. There are a number of differences, and that was one of the things that I thought was important to point out, which might be in the introduction. It's that over the years, it seems like almost all of the folklorists, you know, going back to the late 1800s, with Alphée Fortier, and then the ones I just mentioned from the 40s, it seems like almost everyone was collecting folk tales and proverbs from their own town or their own parish, going all the way back. And there really wasn't any kind of cross-regional analysis going on. And what I found was there really wasn't a big project like this one, a book-length project that was just about analysis of the folk tales. It was more about collections or collecting folk tales with maybe a paragraph or two of commentary, but there wasn't a large-scale study done yet, so I thought that was important. And then especially the historical approach, looking back at Western France, West Africa.
Right, the waves of immigration into Louisiana.
Right. So I felt like that hadn't been done in a really, you know, like a deeper analysis. But certain analogs and comparisons have been made for a while, but I thought that was, to make it a real project, you know, to make that the goal of the book, I thought was still lacking. So
Well, you have a chapter entitled Mystery, Magic, and Curses. And I think that's what some people might think, oh, Louisiana, you know, there's voodoo. There must be a lot of that in the folk tales. But what is it you found as you were doing this more comprehensive study? How do those elements figure in many of the folk tales, that magic and cursing and
Right. Well, that's a good question. It's difficult to write about sometimes, you know, from an objective, as much as possible standpoint, because I think for a lot of people that know these folktale figures and that talk about them, they're really not superstitions. They're not just stories. They're, you know, even play into religion, you know, or vernacular religion. So it's really a matter of perspective. Is it superstition, or is it real, or is it faith? It's really just a matter of how you think about it. So that's something that's difficult to write about because it's hard to remain neutral. You don't want to identify something as a superstition. But there are a few examples that I think people would be familiar with. A good example is the Lugaru or the Rugaru, which is probably one of the most well-known folklore figures in Louisiana, I think, which is comes from the word Lugaru in French, which means werewolf. And in Louisiana, as you probably know, we don't have wolves roaming around. So you'll find, actually, none come to mind, versions where it really is a wolf. People usually describe it as just sort of a kind of vaguely animalistic creature or a dog. I've even found versions where they're an owl, or kind of more bird-like. So it's kind of lost that meaning of wolf over the years. But what's interesting, if you look at the archival record and just any kind of testimony about the Rugaru, that it's never told as a story. You know, it's told as a first person testimony. This is what happened to me. This is the time that I saw what it did to me, or how I got away from it. And so it's really never told as fiction, which I thought was really interesting. And even though it has that French name, one of the most some of the main collection that I found was actually from the Houma community, in Bruce Dutoux's collection from the 1970s. So I think there are a few, the lutin, which is the French word for elf, is also one that I think was sort of maybe a Choctaw and Houma figure that took on the French name, you know, as the Houma adopted the French language really early on. So that I think sometimes the language can maybe mask deeper origins, I think.
Perhaps magical characters we're aware of in other traditions, but they've changed with language and the way we describe them.
Exactly. And another interesting one too is the Fofolé, which again really ties into religion in an important way, because for so many centuries, people believed that that if a child died before baptism, that they would be in what they call limbo. For a while, there were kind of two conceptions of limbo, and this was a real source of anxiety for a lot of people, especially when the infant mortality rate was so much higher in the past, and priests were scarcer. You know, mobility was not what we know today. So, to have an infant die before baptism was probably much more common, and you know, they couldn't have a priest present for the burial. They couldn't be buried in a cemetery, you know, in sacred ground. So it was a real source of fear, I think, for a lot of people. So the Fofolé and a few other, the Letiche is another one, you know, became, I guess, a way of understanding what happens to these children's souls, and so to be followed by these lights that seem to follow passersby in the boats.
Perhaps comfort too, that there are lights and
Right.
yeah, there is some kind of life. One difference that was interesting, and you addressed that too, is that in many fairy tales, folk tales, there's often a hero of great strength, who does great deeds. But that seems to have been transformed in many of the folk tales that we find in Louisiana. You don't find really strong characters. They tend to be more what you mentioned earlier, kind of a trickster.
Right. And I think that's a really common thread through a lot of these folk tales. I really can't think of any, you know, big strong character in Louisiana folklore. They're almost always some kind of trickster. And I think there are reasons for that, because there were just so many different kinds of social pressures against all kinds of people who spoke French and Creole in Louisiana for different reasons. You know, I mentioned slavery and the Jim Crow era, obviously, but also different kinds of linguistic discrimination and even, you know, if you think about French and Creole speakers' relationship to school, it's another thing that really shaped, I think, people's notion of intelligence and, you know, what it means to succeed, because so many French and Creole speakers were punished at school for speaking French, and they had a really difficult relation to sort of the official world of education. And one good example of that, and like you were talking about the heroes too, is Jean Sotte, which means like a foolish John, John the Fool. And this is one you find all over France and Canada. And you know, in those versions I found in France, sometimes he's kind of like almost like the Three Stooges. You know, if you ever seen the Three Stooges, like they're really clumsy, but every now and then they'll do something right at the end and kind of save the day, even though they probably didn't even realize they did. You kind of find that with the Jean Sotte in France, but you never find that in Louisiana. He's just always the fool, and he's always ruining everything. He has just no redeeming qualities. And there are even a tale or two where that's tied into school. You know, like there's one where at the end he goes off and he becomes a professor. So it just shows you like kind of the mistrust, I guess, for formal education. And right. What really matters is, do you know how to survive? Do you know how to take care of the land and the farm and the animals and things? Those things are much more valued than, you know, especially pretending to be smart it never ends well in any of these folk tales. Anyone that's like taking on the air of superiority or supposed intelligence, being official, you know, elite, that's always the bad guy that's going to lose in the end, because the little guy always wins.
But being a wily trickster and canaille is a right. value in
exactly.
many of these tales.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Again, my guest is Nathan Rabelais. His book, Folklore Figures of French and Creole Louisiana, has just been published by LSU Press. He is an assistant professor of Francophone Studies here at UL Lafayette. And I found the epilogue of your book really fascinating, because you deal with a lot of questions, you know, that we all have about what has happened to our culture. What has happened to French Louisiana in the 21st century? And it's fascinating how you ponder that and analyze that. You do obviously talk about, you know, things we're all aware of, marketing, tourism, and you talk about recycled folklore.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and how does that play in your understanding of what has happened and may happen to our folklore in South Louisiana?
Mm-hmm. That's a term that was, it comes from Frank DeCaro, who was at LSU, great folklorist at LSU, who passed away rather recently, unfortunately. But he had a really astute way of looking at newer uses of folklore, like in festivals and literature, that I thought was really interesting. But I thought it would be important to include that in the book, you know, even though it doesn't have a lot to do with the main chapters in the book, because it's a question that I think comes up for anyone that would read those main chapters. It's like, okay, well, what about now?
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I think, really creative ways of drawing on folklore, because I think for people in North America, and I think, you know, In this part of Louisiana is a good example. We don't have, you know, like in Spain and England and other European countries, this medieval past, you know, or these medieval characters to draw on as sort of emblems of our identity. It just doesn't go back that far, you know. I think for a lot of people, the medieval era is like the essence of a national, kind of a national identity. And for us, I think folklore plays that role in understanding who we are. So that's why I think it's important and logical that it comes up in different kinds of festivals and children's literature that like new children's literature too. We still see recent books with characters like Buki and Lapin in them. And there are other ones too, you know, like Clovis the Crawfish and like kind of newer folklore-like stories that people really enjoy. Another thing I talk about is just how much of these kind of folklore figures you see, not just in Louisiana, but all over the place with like craft beers. Mm. And distilleries really, really draw on folklore imagery for naming their products. So I think that's interesting. Another term that was coined by Priscilla Denby is folklore. Mm. So like folklore is sort of a marketing tool.
Right.
And I think that's another place that we see folklore, but it's not so much to paint it in a negative light. That wasn't my intention. It just sort of wanted to give more of a survey of where you might find some of these folklore figures today. And what I found was that the ones that really persisted, I think, or like the best examples would be the Rougarou and then Buki and Lapin. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that they're really easily recognizable to people outside of Louisiana and even to ourselves, because I think there's been kind of a break in the transmission of a lot of these things. So I think some younger people might be discovering them for the first time. But the Buki and Lapin are so close to the Br'er Rabbit stories that people are probably already familiar with, maybe a little bit less so today. And then everyone knows what a werewolf is, you know, even though, like I said, the Rougarou is never really described as a wolf. But I think that's where we see the most continuity, is those ones that are easily relatable to people outside, because they can already know them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with your book now, people will be much more familiar with some of these figures and some of these tales, and who knows where they'll end up, Nathan, and how what figures people will be using on their craft beer or new, you know, young writers, just in the same way that young musical groups mined the archives here at UL and other places. Your book will be one place that young writers may go to find these characters, these figures, and to create, you know, their new stories, their reimagined stories. So, a great use, and I know people will be very grateful that you have gathered these stories in one book, and not just gathered them, but really gave a sense of the narrative of where they came from, you know, the historical immigration waves and the cultural trauma that you mentioned, that really gives us a sense of how important and why these figures were so important over the centuries here in Louisiana. So it's a great service you've done with this book, and I know it will be a great pleasure for many people to read as well and discover and recognize elements of their culture. So would going to the LSU website, LSU Press website, be a good way to find out more about the book?
Sure. There's a page on there where people can read about it. It's called Folklore Figures of French and Creole Louisiana, and it's available there. But it's pretty widely available. It's in some local bookstores, too, and pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, people are good about finding those places. Yeah. Well, Nathan, we thank you so much for all of your hard work. I know years ago you helped us out here at KRVS, and then you just took off on your academic path, and it's been fascinating to watch what you've done and what you've been producing, documentary film, and then now this lovely book, Folklore Figures of French and Creole Louisiana. So we're very grateful for all your work, and like so many young, just energetic, creative young people, you've really taken this culture and helped us all understand it better and done research, so we know far more about it. So un grand merci.
Merci beaucoup,
for that. Yes. Well, we look forward to your work in the future and having you back here at KRVS to tell us more about it. But the book Folklore Figures of French and Creole Louisiana was published by LSU Press by my guest, Nathan Rabelais, Assistant Professor of Francophone Studies here at UL Lafayette. Thank you so much, Nathan.
Thank you, Judith.